Robert Louis Stevenson's classic novella, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, begins the way the best mysteries begin, with a chance encounter. Something happens that seems off. Our protagonist, can't get it out of their head, begins investigating and things just get weirder. Mr. Utterson, a stern but kind-hearted London lawyer, is talking to his friend, Richard Enfield, who has a story for Utterson. Some months ago, Enfield was on his way home, late at night, and in the foggy city street, he saw an old man shambling along. A young girl, maybe 8 or 10 years old, was running along a cross street. The man and the girl were too close to a blind corner to see each other, and they collided. Then, according to Enfield, the man trampled calmly over the child's body and left her screaming on the ground. It sounds nothing to hear, but it was hellish to see. It wasn't like a man, says Enfield. It was like some damned juggernaut. What is a juggernaut? It's a good SAT vocabulary word, and if you've read enough books in English, you can probably define it reasonably well. Something big, lumbering, and unstoppable. It has connotations of being destructive to its surroundings and being out of control. Things I've described as juggernauts on this channel before are the pre-1960s Hollywood studio system, Siegfried and Roy's hydraulic dragon, and pop feminism in the 2010s. An approximate synonym might be behemoth. But the word behemoth originally referred to a specific thing, a fearsome creature described in the Old Testament, probably a hippo, and the word juggernaut was also originally not a metaphor but a particular object. In 19th century Britain, where Robert Louis Stevenson wrote Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, his audience would be expected to know exactly what he was comparing Mr. Hyde to, trampling a child in the street like some damned juggernaut. A juggernaut was the English word for a Hindu temple chariot. These are the oldest, most amazing parade floats in the world. At festivals across India, known as Ratha Yatras, or chariot festivals, giant wooden chariots, some of them up to 3 stories tall, slowly make their way through crowds of worshippers, carrying idols of Hindu gods. Often an idol of one god is carried to a temple of another god across town. Then, days or weeks later, there's another chariot festival as the god travels back home. Sometimes horses or elephants pull the chariots. In other places, the crowd carefully pushes or drags the chariot along. Usually, the process of building and carving a brand new chariot every year is part of the festivities. The most famous Ratha Yatra has taken place in Puri, in the eastern state of Odisha, every summer for hundreds, possibly thousands of years. If someone says they've been to the Ratha Yatra, they probably mean this one, the same way the Comic Con refers to the one in San Diego. The Puri Ratha Yatra celebrates the god Jagannath. Now you know where the English word juggernaut comes from. And from the medieval days onward, garbled stories of the Ratha Yatra in Puri captured the European imagination. India and the West have always been closer than you think. The popular image of the Buddha is inspired by Greek statues. In fact, because of Alexander the Great's conquests, Greek was the main language spoken in parts of the Himalayas for hundreds of years. There are Christians in the south of India who date back to the very dawn of Christianity, when, according to oral tradition in both Europe and India, Thomas the Apostle sailed out into the east after the crucifixion and evangelized some Indians. The Buddha became a popularly venerated saint in the medieval Catholic Church under the name Saint Josephat. When Marco Polo headed out to Asia and met Buddhists, he told them that, yeah, we know about that guy, Christians like him too. India was a fascinating land of mystery to medieval Europeans, but everyone knew it was a real place. People had been there and come back to tell the tale. Everything intriguing and exotic was said to come from India, from animals like lions and elephants, sure, to things like blemmies and dog-headed people. Watch my video about Prester John to learn about those. And the Ratha Yatra in Puri was common knowledge to educated Europeans from the 14th century onward. What put the Ratha Yatra front and center in Western legends of India was a detail so striking it couldn't be overlooked. According to the few Europeans who had been there, as the massive temple chariot creaked its way through the streets of Puri, devotees would throw themselves under the gigantic wheels and be crushed, as a seemingly deliberate, spontaneous, ecstatic sacrifice to Jagannath. This is why juggernaut came to mean what it does. Did people really do this? Where does this land on the elephants to dog-headed people spectrum? To this day, we can't be sure. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian, Thimble the Doll, and Sluds the Shoggoth. And welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. First Western account
of the Ratayatra in Puri comes from Odoric of Pordenone, an Italian monk who traveled to today's India, Indonesia, China, and Mongolia in the 1320s. Odoric does not identify Jagannath by name, and he places the festival in a kingdom called Mobar, possibly a mishearing of Malabar, an Arab name for the west coast of southern India that has been used inconsistently for different parts of South India by Westerners over the years. All we know about its location is that it's the same country as the grave of St. Thomas, which is believed today to be in the southeastern city of Chennai, but we don't know if Thomas was actually buried there, and it's possible Indian Christian tradition situated St. Thomas's grave somewhere else. So Odoric could have gone to Puri, he could have gone somewhere completely different, but he probably went to Puri because he describes the worship of Jagannath in detail, devoting a whole page to rituals of pilgrims praying to the idol of Jagannath. He just doesn't say Jagannath. Then, almost as an afterthought, he says, "Annually on the recurrence of the day when the idol was made, the folk of the country come and take it down, and put it on a fine chariot, and then the king and queen and all the pilgrims, and the whole body of the people join together and draw it forth from the church with loud singing of songs and all kinds of music, and many maidens go before it two and two, chaunting in a marvelous manner. And many pilgrims who have come to this feast cast themselves under the chariot, so that its wheels may go over them, saying they desire to die for their god. And the car passes over them, and crushes and cuts them in sunder, and so they perish on the spot. And after this fashion they drag the idol to a certain customary place, and then they drag him back to where he was formerly, with singing and playing as before. And thus not a year passes, but there perish more than 500 men in this manner, and their bodies they burn, declaring they are holy, having thus devoted themselves to death for their god." Medieval Western travelers said all kinds of weird shit about Asia, but the fact that this comes from Odoric of Pordenone is interesting because Odoric is generally considered to be the gold standard as medieval European descriptions of Asia go. There's this theory that Marco Polo, who traveled to some of the same places about 50 years before Odoric, didn't actually go to China and just cribbed his writing from popular myths about the place. It's a fringe theory and doesn't have much academic support, but one of my Chinese history professors at Lewis and Clark College told the whole class that this was the academic consensus. She was also the same person who insisted the modern-day social credit system was real, and told me the purple dye used in Roman senators' togas came from Guangdong, which I uncritically repeated in my Prester John episode, even after having debunked her two previous whoppers. Of course the Romans' purple dye didn't come from China, it came from Phoenicia. That's sort of the whole point of Phoenicia. Anyway, people who don't think Marco Polo went to China point to his lack of description of some things you'd kind of expect him to write about. He doesn't say anything about the Great Wall, doesn't mention foot binding, and doesn't mention chopsticks. There are various reasonable explanations for all these things, and most other medieval European travelers to China didn't mention them either. But Odoric did. He didn't mention the wall, but it was in ruins at the time anyway and had yet to be rebuilt by the Ming Dynasty. Odoric was not an exaggerator. His descriptions of China and India are some of the most detailed and accurate from their time, stacking up with Chinese and Indian descriptions of their own lives whenever a comparison can be made. Even Odoric's more shocking claims about places he'd been, such as a description of casual, commonplace cannibalism of child slaves in Sumatra, have been borne out by the historical record. So, how do we take this story of mass sacrifices? Well, would devotees of Jagannath do this? Are there other cases of human sacrifice like this in Hinduism? To answer this question, we need to back up to a question more difficult and less basic than it sounds. Who is a Hindu, and what is Hinduism? Hinduism is the most complicated global religion by far. It's almost worth calling it a thousand religions in a trench coat. Christians have always called themselves Christians, Muslims have always called themselves Muslims, but until relatively recently, Hindus didn't call themselves Hindus, at least not to mean a religion. Read any Western writing on India from the Middle Ages through to independence, and Hindu is used to mean Indian people regardless of religion. To outsiders discovering India, there were Muslims there, Christians, Buddhists, and then there were the ones who practiced the other, India-specific faiths, the Hindu religions. There are common features to nearly every sect called Hinduism, most notably the concept of dharma, roughly the rules for living a life in harmony with the universe, but what those rules are vary depending on the sect. There are no founder figures and no central texts. There are books like the Mahabharata and the Bhagavad Gita, among many others, but nobody is supposed to believe those are infallible or literally happened.
There's no set list of precepts like the Ten Commandments or the Buddhist Eightfold Path. There's a series of texts called the Vedas, but sects differ on how much authority, if any, to put on them. Hinduism is fundamentally henotheistic, meaning most Hindus worship one supreme being, but they don't deny the existence of other gods. They are polytheistic, but believe one god is a bigger deal than all the others. Which god is the most important one is the main thing differentiating Hindu sects. Hindu has sects, but it doesn't have much sectarianism. You can be in multiple sects at once, and plenty of Hindus don't consider themselves a member of any sect. Where one Hindu god ends and another begins is a fuzzy boundary, and some gods are considered the same god in some parts of India and separate ones in other parts. Any two Hindus may each worship a different god, but they'll often agree that they really worship the same one under different names and attributes. Or they might worship the same one, but one of them will consider their god an avatar of Vishnu and the other an avatar of Shiva or something like that. And Jagannath is a particularly unique Hindu god. No matter where you're from, you probably have a mental image of what a Hindu god looks like. They're humanoid, often with several arms, sometimes with skin that's blue or another interesting color, possibly with an animal head, but usually all their features are broadly human. There's always a lot of detail, so if you believe in these gods, you could picture yourself, as you are, meeting them and shaking hands, and hands, and hands, and hands. Alright, now this is Jagannath. Look at those giant round eyes and smile. It almost feels weird to consider that this modern-looking, cartoonish face has been worshipped for thousands of years. Jagannath is practically an emoji. He's the only major Hindu god who is represented abstractly like this, instead of as a human or animal figure. Idols of Jagannath are usually made out of a log, and there are multiple different origin myths of Jagannath that call him a log or stump brought to life by other gods. Why? Where does Jagannath come from? Nobody's sure. Historians have attributed the origins of Jagannath to pre-Hindu folk traditions, to a whole bunch of different Hindu sects, to Jainism, and even to Buddhism, pointing out the parallels between the celebration of Jagannath and festivals celebrating relics of the Buddha. Most likely, Jagannath's origins are a little bit of each. Jagannath is by far the best illustration of Hinduism as a thousand local traditions in a trench coat. Now, human sacrifice and religious suicide are directly condemned in some Hindu texts, but the fact that the monks of old who put quill to paper even thought about writing prohibitions of those things suggests that they must have been practiced by someone in ancient India, and if any Hindu sect were to retain traditions like this from an older, wilder form of Hinduism, it would be the worshippers of Jagannath, I think. I was talking about this episode idea with a friend of mine a few weeks ago, and I showed him some photos of Hindu temple chariots, and he said, "I'd commit suicide in front of one of those." And I mean, put yourself in the shoes of a pilgrim in medieval India and consider this. There's nothing like one of these temple chariots today, but it would have been even more extraordinary at the time. People reacted like they'd seen God or the devil at the invention of trains, and the chariot of Jagannath was way bigger than a train, centuries before trains. These were most likely the largest land vehicles ever built, right up to the invention of jumbo jets and modern mining equipment. And those don't even have a religious purpose. In the West, people talk about how you can walk into a cathedral and really feel the presence of God, even if you're not a particularly religious person, just from the size and beauty and majesty of it all. To this day, it's not uncommon for spontaneous conversions to Christianity to happen when people walk into Notre Dame or St. Peter's, to step in and be overwhelmed and say, "Take me home, God." And that's from a religion that doesn't put a strong emphasis on literally seeing God compared to Hinduism. Idolatry is a sin in Christianity, and Islam takes it even further by prohibiting depictions of Muhammad, but Hinduism is all about idols. There's a word in Hinduism for a concept without a strong parallel in Abrahamic religions, darshan, or visually seeing divinity. Sight is one of the fundamental ways Hindu worship works. When you go on a Hindu pilgrimage, you're doing it so you can darshan a god with your own eyes. It works both ways. When you darshan a god, the god also darshans you. And Jagannath, uniquely among Hindu gods, has those huge haunting eyes. Anywhere those eyes can see you, you are in the presence of the divine. Imagine you're a pilgrim who's traveled hundreds of miles on foot to see the Ratha Yatra. What kind of person in medieval India does that? You probably have no strong attachments back home. You're deeply religious, and that's the main force driving your life. Your day-to-day existence is most likely nothing special, and you know that if you die now, at the culmination of the biggest commitment to your faith you've ever made, you'll be reborn into a much better existence than what you've got today. The chariot is more beautiful and extraordinary than anything you could imagine, and up there, you see the huge eyes of Jagannath. You darshan the god darshans you. In normal times, you know the idol is made of a log, the eyes are painted on, but now the chariot is rolling, and you are making eye contact with a god, here and now in the material plane. Clearly, Jagannath is lord of the universe. Well, there's your shortcut. Everyone's doing it. What have you got to lose? Oderic was the first European to document the Ratha Yatra, but he wouldn't be the last. And as the British began crawling across India, they began to write about Jagannath in terms best described as Lovecraftian. In 1806, the missionary Claudius Buchanan recounted personally witnessing people dying at the Ratha Yatra and called the festival the chief feat of Moloch in the whole earth, adding, "No record, ancient or modern history can give, I think, an adequate idea of this valley of death." Multiple early 19th century accounts of Brits visiting Puri outside the festival season describe the main street being littered with bones from previous sacrifices. As Jagannath began to capture the British imagination, increasingly lurid and exaggerated descriptions of the Ratha Yatra appeared in Western newspapers, all from people who claimed to have been there. One famous account began with the observation that even 50 miles away from Puri, the bones by the road began to accumulate. In 1824, the London magazine The Mirror attempted to calculate the average death toll of the Ratha Yatra, concluding that 120,000 people died there every year, although they noted that estimates varied of how many people sacrificed themselves versus attending the festival without sacrificing themselves, and, quote, "some are of opinion that not many more than 1 in 10 survive and return home again." Well, this is obviously sensationalism, but there are several different eyewitness accounts of the Ratha Yatra from around this time that attempt to take accurate statistics of the number of sacrifices, usually coming up with a number in the hundreds, often saying they personally went through the streets after the chariot passed and counted the bodies. There were conflicts between Christian missionaries, who identified Jagannath with the devil and wanted to end his worship by any means necessary, and the mainstream British authorities, who feared a general uprising if they attacked Hindu traditions and preferred to levy a tax on every pilgrim coming to see Jagannath. The tax revenue was sometimes seen as blood money, and accounts of the brutality of the Ratha Yatra often blamed the British for allowing it to continue. But amid this debate, the Western media coverage of Jagannath starts to change. As early as the 1820s, defenders of the pilgrim tax occasionally claimed that human sacrifices had already been successfully stamped out and never happened at the Ratha Yatra anymore. By the 1850s, this became the majority view. You even get dueling accounts of people who attended the Ratha Yatra and just saw a parade versus people who attended the Ratha Yatra right around the same time and saw a bloodbath. There were a few decades in the 19th century where Western accounts of the Ratha Yatra were an absolute mess. British people stationed in India all claiming firsthand that either the sacrifices were still going on but not in the numbers they used to, or had been totally stamped out, or never ever happened at all, a claim I can first find surfacing in the 1830s. After the 1850s, claims that sacrifices to Jagannath were still happening in all their gory splendor seem to have been relegated to confused Westerners outside India. I think we can be sure of that, at least. If there had ever been mass sacrifices at the Ratha Yatra, they weren't common anymore by the 1850s. Still, some didn't get the memo. One, entertainingly, was Karl Marx, who wrote in an 1853 essay criticizing British rule in India that the British capitalists were putting profit ahead of human rights by taxing the Jagannath pilgrims instead of stopping the bloodshed at the festival, sarcastically noting, "These are the men of property, order, family, and religion," implying that if they truly cared about any of those things, they'd crack down on the sacrifices that Marx seemingly believed were still going on. Marx also associates Jagannath with temple prostitution, which was another thing the British claimed went on at these festivals, but historians now agree was a myth. William Wilson Hunter, a Scottish historian who was Victorian Britain's main chronicler of Indian culture and geography, wrote about Jagannath in 1872 in an essay later published in his massive 26-volume encyclopedia on India. He attempts to humanize the worshippers of Jagannath, calling most of the previous writing about the festival, quote, quite imaginary. But he doesn't directly say nobody ever threw themselves under the wheels of the chariot. Instead, he says some people probably did, but they were old, sick, or both, seeking to end their fragile lives in a quick and controllable way. This is a one-off. I can't find any other source claiming that most of the people who died at the Ratha Yatra were old, but it's a fascinatingly plausible hypothesis. Plenty of cultures that otherwise frown on ending your life accept the euthanasia of the elderly, sometimes even making it into a common cultural ritual. A lot of these are generally seen as myths too. People in Japan carrying their parents up to die on mountaintops, cliffs in Sweden where local legend claims old people were forced to jump, the Inuit sending elders off to float to sea on an ice floe, all of which may have happened once or twice in times of famine, but never as a common thing. But the best documented case of mercy killings of the elderly as a common cultural phenomenon comes from India. In fact, a part of India not too far from Puri. In Tamil Nadu, at the southern tip of India, old people regularly die by thalai kutal, in which they drink so many glasses of coconut water that it causes kidney failure and they slip into a coma. It's a whole ceremony, with generations of their family present, something of a living funeral. Authorities in Tamil Nadu have tried to stop families from thalai kutaling their elders from the colonial period right up to the present day, and there are cases of non-consensual thalai kutal. Even most Tamils today see it as a weird old rural tradition, but usually people who die by thalai kutal chose it for themselves. So what if this is true? What if people took their loved ones to Puri so they could die in the presence of the gods and only stopped doing it because the British misinterpreted their intentions and stamped it out? It makes so much sense to me. The only reason I'm not ending the episode here is because of the hundreds of sources across the full spectrum of skepticism, this is the only one I could find that even suggests this as a hypothesis. There's another similar Indian tradition, one that the deaths at the Ratha Yatra were often compared to, the practice of suti, or sati, as it's usually spelled today, widows being burned alive on their husband's funeral pyre. Despite how zealously the act of sati was promoted as an example of Indian barbarism that the Brits had to put an end to the point that you've probably heard of it and might consider it a myth, sati was not a myth. Whether there were mass sacrifices to Jagannath is an open question. No serious historian believes sati never happened. Like the purported sacrifices to Jagannath, like people who die from thalai kutal, most women who died by sati did so voluntarily. It was also a form of ritual euthanasia for the elderly, because most women who lose their husbands are themselves quite old, and I feel like when you're old and you've lost your lifelong partner, it's considered pretty normal in most cultures to want to follow them into the dark. There are well-documented cases of women in India having to be drugged and thrown on their husband's pyre, which is the situation in most Western depictions of sati, but that wasn't the norm. But here's the big blind spot in this episode, the big blind spot in all research about Jagannath. Every single source I've cited so far comes from a Westerner. That's not always bad. Travel narratives are crucial for historians because foreigners describe things that locals take for granted and never mention, but is there anything at all written about deaths at the Ratha Yatra by Indians? Medieval India was a highly literate society by the standards of the time. In all my searching, I could find only one source written by a practicing Hindu alleging that people sacrificed themselves at the Ratha Yatra. It's from 1848, and it's from A History of the City of Puri, written by Brij Kishore Ghosh, a city administrator under the British. He mentioned sacrifices, and he called it barbaric and un-Hindu, but he was a collaborator with the Empire. It's possible he was trying to villainize the priests of Jagannath, who represented the other main source of power in Puri. Ultimately, I think voluntary sacrifices can't have been common at the Ratha Yatra because there isn't a body of literature by Indians for Indians debating it. The practice of sati is documented by hundreds of years of Hindu priests and monks and philosophers and magistrates going back and forth on whether this practice is okay or not, because sati was always controversial, and many previous rulers of India, whether they were Muslim, Buddhist, or Hindu, all tried to stamp out sati just like the Brits did, and it always had a base of supporters, typically devout and rural, who defended it. The Radha Yatra has always been one of India's biggest pilgrimage destinations. If mass suicides happened there every year, they would have to be completely uncontroversial for there to be no Hindu texts discussing them. And given that most Hindu texts are explicitly against human sacrifice, there's no way it would be uncontroversial. Could it have happened? Sure. Could it have happened on the scale that some sources say it did? I have a hard time believing that. Note that the Mughal Empire, the Muslim dynasty that ruled India before the British, also frowned on the worship of Jagannath. It was them, not the Brits, who first instituted the tax on pilgrims to Puri. The Mughal also associated Jagannath with the devil through a Muslim lens, but never, in any of their surviving invectives against Jagannath, do they mention mass voluntary sacrifices, something that I think they would have emphasized pretty hard if they were trying to paint Jagannath as evil. And yet, there are some accounts that give me pause, things that make me think this really must have happened, at least on a small scale. I found two separate eyewitness accounts of three seemingly deliberate deaths taking place at the 1864 Ratha Yatra, the most recent date where I can find a reference to people sacrificing themselves to Jagannath. While not word for word the same, the two accounts, one published in Allen's Indian Mail, one of the main English language news sources in British India, the other published in the New York Times under the heading The Great Juggernaut Saturnalia, good name for a 2000s indie band, they're so similar in their details, I think they must have been written by the same person, though I don't have any proof. Each one is so full of specific details, details that stay consistent between the two retellings, that I feel pretty confident that this person really did attend the Ratha Yatra and saw what they say they saw. And this is a really interesting take on the sacrifices. The author describes seeing three people crushed under the wheels. The only one who gets a physical description is, tantalizingly, quote, a very old woman, all wrinkled and puckered up. But after these three people die, the parade stops. Everyone is appropriately horrified. The Brahmin, the priests standing up on the chariot with Jagannath, order people to get away from the chariot, and police carry away the bodies before the festivities slowly begin again. But it doesn't look like an accident. According to this witness, the people who were crushed seem to have been lying down in the path of the wheels. They even wrote that two men had been lying right in front of the wheels when the chariot stopped, and they stood up, looked around, and walked away embarrassed. The impression this article gives is clear. Deliberate sacrifices were still taking place on a small scale, but they were strongly discouraged, and most Hindus saw them the same way the British saw them. But by the time that article was published, the last known eyewitness account of sacrifices at the Ratha Yatra, most of the British press had moved on beyond the old lurid depictions of Jagannath. This shift is interesting because it feels anachronistically woke, I guess you could say. Starting around 1870, there's a wave of articles across the Western world that loudly deny that any sacrifices ever took place, that urge people to call the god Jagannath instead of Juggernaut, and often end with some version of the sentiment that even if people used to die by the hundreds at the Ratha Yatra, nothing about that is foreign or barbaric. We have Jagannath at home. Because now, Jagannath was a point of comparison for crowd crushes. That was the new understanding of why people got crushed by the chariot of Jagannath. Accidental crowd crushes. An 1872 article in the London Examiner is headlined, Our Juggernaut, decrying political rallies taking place in London's narrow Fleet Street, referring to, quote, difficulty in distinguishing that carnival of loyalty from the Hindu fete. In both cases, enormous crowds are gathered in unsuitable places and without adequate precautions. An 1882 article about the now-peaceful Ratha Yatra includes the claim that, quote, the British cab is a much more bloodthirsty institution than the car of Jagannatha. And this, at long last, is a really compelling narrative. Deadly crowd crushes at religious festivals are common to this day. Every few years, the Hajj is marred by a massive crowd crush, and as the world's Muslim population expands and becomes increasingly rich and able to travel, it's only getting worse. 1,400 Muslims were trampled to death in a tunnel in the 1990 Hajj. 346 pilgrims died in 2006, and in possibly the worst crowd crush in history, 2,400 died at once in the 2015 Hajj. The Hajj is the biggest annual pilgrimage in the world, but not the biggest pilgrimage there is. The true biggest is another Hindu festival, the Kumbh Mela, which happens in four different places on a schedule based on the movements of Jupiter. And yes, at the most recent Kumbh Mela, there was a deadly crowd crush. They aren't specific to religious pilgrimages either. Some of the biggest non-religious crowd crushes have happened at music festivals and sports stadiums. None of these events have a giant, heavy, nearly unsteerable chariot lumbering through the crowd. How people die in a disaster like the one at the Hajj is that the crowd gets so thick, everyone is pressed up against everyone else, being held into place or even carried along by each other. The pressure on some people is so intense they pass out and collapse. Since everyone is leaning on everyone else, people fall into the holes created in the crowd where people collapse and get trampled by the people still standing. If you designed an event specifically so that it would generate huge deadly crowd crushes, it would be something like this. It would be a nationally known religious pilgrimage site that attracts people from all across one of the world's most populous countries. It would take place in a city street with buildings on both sides. There would be one specific object everyone prays to and tries to get close to, and while pilgrims bow and chant and look at an idol high up on the towering structure, it would slowly and unpredictably move forward, even as the whole crowd is trying to get toward it. At all times, some people would be in a state of rapture praying to the god, and some people would be in a state of panic trying to move out of its way. Looking at the Ratha Yatra that way, the sensationalized estimate that only 1 in 10 survive seems almost plausible. In fact, it seems remarkable that the crowd control problem was ever successfully solved, but from the evidence we've got, sometime in the early 19th century, before the British had penetrated much into that part of India, it was. So, here's my just-so story about Jagannath. It may be true, it's probably not. The answer is most likely more complicated than we can know, and only with a time machine and some good disguises will we ever be sure. But I choose to believe that in the 14th century, Odoric of Pordenone was invited to visit the Ratha Yatra in Puri, watching from a building overlooking the main street as the chariot of Jagannath creaks its way through the city. He witnesses a massive crowd crush. Thousands of people packed densely together, all bowing and chanting and paying their respects to Jagannath, all while trying to move out of the way of the chariot's slow, colossal wheels. Suddenly, the chariot lurches forward. People scatter, trying to move in all directions at once. The crowd of people standing further away from the chariot, trying to get closer, blocks the people closer to it from getting away. In a blink of an eye, hundreds are crushed under the wheels of the chariot. Could this be a sacrifice? It certainly looks like one to Odoric, but he has to be sure. Perhaps after the festivities die down, he seeks out one of the Brahmin who had overseen the festival. Presumably he had an interpreter traveling with him who could speak Odia, the language they speak in that part of India. I have a hard time imagining Odoric happened upon the Ratha Yatra without learning about its significance from a local. Through an interpreter, Odoric asks the Brahmin, "What happened when all those people got crushed?" To which the Brahmin responds, "Ah, a terrible accident, such a tragedy, but at least they came all this way to pray to Jagannath when they died. At least they were close to divinity. They'll be reincarnated into better lives, all of them." In a choppy rendition of whatever common language Odoric would have shared with the interpreter, Latin, Arabic maybe, Persian, Greek, I don't know, the interpreter tries to explain this to Odoric. Nobody here is speaking their first language. "What will happen to the remains of the victims?" Odoric asks. "Well, they'll be cremated, of course," says the Brahmin, in his mind not needing to explain that this is the way all Hindus dispose of their dead. "Does this happen every year?" "Sadly, yes," says the Brahmin. "With all the people who come here from all across India, it's quite common for crowd crushes like this to form." Through a series of reasonable misinterpretations, Odoric goes on to write that Indian people sacrifice themselves to the chariot of their god Jagannath. And this maps closer to the modern English language meaning of juggernaut, I think. If people were choosing to sacrifice themselves to Jagannath, presumably there was also an option to get out of the way and not sacrifice yourself. But a juggernaut, in today's language, is something merciless and unavoidable, plowing down everything in its way, whether or not it wants to be there. At some point, that was what the chariot of Jagannath in Puri was. Remember, they build a brand new chariot every year. It could have been much more difficult to control in the past. It seems as if, starting around 1800, whether because of looming British rule or not, maybe even because this had provoked a campaign of suppression from the Mughal Empire in the past, there was a deliberate effort by the people and priests of Puri to end the days of crowd crushes at the Ratha Yatra, with gradual but steady success. This explanation doesn't tie up every single loose end, but most likely nothing will. It's a very satisfying one to me, at least. With careful planning, even a juggernaut can be tamed.
Love.